Hi everyone, and welcome to this new episode of Guida Galattica per Fisioterapisti Intervista. Today we have a special guest, Ian Gatt. Hi Ian.
Hi, how are you doing, Alberto?
Thanks, Ian. Yeah, very good, thanks. So with Ian today, we're going to discuss a lot of topic, but a lot will be around his work with boxing, but we're going to cover it throughout the podcast. First of all, Ian, as always for our guests, we normally ask to introduce themselves to our community. So if you want to talk a little bit more about your background and your professional experience, just to introduce yourself to all our colleagues.
Yeah, so Ian Gatt, some of my colleagues, even across the club, call me the Gatman. So it's a bit of a nickname, really. You know, a lot of the athletes know me like that, and coaches and so on. But yeah, I've been working in sports for over 20 years now, pretty much embedded in different full-time roles. I'm currently the head of performance and also lead physiotherapist for GB Boxing. I've been the lead physio for more than a decade now, so I think close to 12 years. But in the last 2 years, I've also picked up the head of performance. What does that mean? It means we've got, including myself, 16 practitioners working in the sports science and medicine team with boxing. We've got 8 disciplines. So you've got the physio and the doctors, then you've got your psychologist, performance lifestyle, you've got your performance analysts, nutritionist, physiologist, and strength and conditioning coach. So it is a big team, but obviously we've got a lot of athletes. We've got over 40 boxers within the squads. We've got lots of coaches and a wider personnel. So altogether, lots of numbers, as you can imagine. Apart from the clinical aspect, over the years I've been involved in different things. So apart from the sports, I've also and still offer private consultations, particularly around the sporting environment, but say particularly around the upper limb, so your hands, wrist, your elbows, your shoulders. Within the English Institute of Sport, for those who don't know what it is the organization which provides the majority of services for all Olympic and Paralympic sports in the country. And that means that a lot of physios come together, a lot of doctors come together from all these different sports. So a lot of cross collaboration and with knowledge. And within the EIS, I'm privileged to be one of the specialists in the upper limb, looking at helping other practitioners with areas of collaborating in areas of what we call community of practice, which is increasing the knowledge and trying to help that. I think with that, with the education, I do lots of different bits of education, same as I'm doing with yourself, Paolo, as part of this and this podcast, and obviously linking to the webinar, which we'll talk later. I've done a lot with different providers and also run different courses, whether they're established and they are ready for people to pick on, or we have live courses, which I run through different distributors. But with the courses, I also link with research. So I myself am doing a PhD in RIS biomechanics at Sheffield Hallam University. I've published papers in collaboration with colleagues. I've reviewed peer-reviewed journals myself. And so I think when you look at all together, I think I come from that area of trying to combine everything together. I know it seems very busy and it is busy, but for me, everything links together. So you've got the clinical component, you know, of sports and also even learning from, you know, not just boxing, the other sports, learning from the private area, looking at the research element of things, and also looking at, you know, within the research and the clinical is the education. And I think one feeds from the other in a way to try and always be as much as possible, always improving things, always pushing things further.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the link between then the university and the research and the clinical aspect is very, very important. So today, first question will be obviously about your role in boxing. Just what we want to know a little bit more is what is for you just another day at the office. What do you normally do as a physio working in boxing during the training period?
Yeah, well, I'm privileged because I've got 3 full-time physios working with me. I think my role over the years has changed. When I first started 10 years ago, I was the only physio full-time. And I think like many physios who work full-time in a particular sport, you end up doing all the management strategies, all the treatment strategies, you know, covering trips, going away. And I think, you know, I used to be probably more away from home than I actually used to be at home. So, you know, definitely it's not the sort of role for married life if you're all the time on the road. Luckily, as we had better success and more funding involved in it, we've managed to recruit more people. And now at least I've got 3 full-time physios. So I've managed to take a little bit of a step back from being that hands-on person and actually be more in a role of guiding the other physios, ensuring that the plans are doing well, and also from a management point of view is ensuring that it's not just, you know, the physio is looking at things from a physio point of view, it's a cross collaboration with other disciplines. As I mentioned earlier, I've got lots of disciplines, you know, from S&C to performance analysis to psychology. So I think most of the roles I do on a day-to-day is just ensuring we're leaving no stones unturned. We're ticking all the boxes. People can troubleshoot with me. So, you know, they come to me with ideas, with problems. And also, it's for me, is making sure that we don't remain still, because it's very easy just to be reactive in all the things you're doing. And as a profession and also as a sport, that we don't move forward. So, you know, I talked earlier about the research. I talked earlier about lots of the other things I do, even around education. It's useless just talking about it if we're not importing those things into our clinical practice. So it's trying to make sure that what is out there that we can import it, but equally sometimes is that you are in a very isolated situation because of the type of athletes you see and a very small cohort, that sometimes you have to create your own evidence. You know, sometimes you can do it as a research project and you publish it, and we have published papers from boxing in our cohort, which have been really where the feedback was really good from international people. However, sometimes you don't have the time to do research all the time. It's a day job. So I think if you ask me, what do you do on a single day? I say every day is different. You know, one day can be more heavy around the athlete management of things in collaboration with my team. Other days is maybe a bit more on the management at a higher level. So talking about, you know, at the moment, one of the biggest theme in any sport is COVID. So you can imagine that every day we're talking about how we're going to get athletes abroad to international competition, what they have to do when they return, how are they going to be safe? How are we safe in our training environment? So just probably dominating our headlines on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, definitely. And then you mentioned obviously the traveling and the events. And my next question is about this, because obviously, for example, in football, we know what is required for a physio, that is pitch side covering a game. So the ref is calling the physio on and to assess or to manage the acute injury. But what's actually the role of a physio in boxing, like during a competition?
Yeah, well, during the actual competition, it depends on the different, the different organizations. You know, some associations might use a physio as a cutman, and some associations may not. They just think like, you know, we'll just use the coaches. So it varies. The thing is, to be a cutman, it's important to have a bit of a medical background. You don't need to be a physio. You could be a physio, you could be a doctor, or you could be a coach who is really well trained in those areas, because obviously you'd be looking at things like your facial cuts, you'd be looking at possibly any signs of head trauma and so on and so forth. I mean, I've been privileged because I've been in also done cuts both in the Olympic setup, but also in professional boxing. So I can see obviously the transference of, as you said, in football, if you are pit side, you know what you're doing, or you have an idea what you're doing. If you are ringside, you know, So it's different. You're ringside. You only have 1 minute and probably less in between rounds to actually do what you have to do. So knowing what to do and doing it quickly is really important. But sometimes the role of the physio, if you're not in the ring, is what you do before. You know, physios tend to wrap hands sometimes. Again, it depends on the type of association and the boxers. But in GB, definitely we'll wrap the hands. We'll help the coaches, you know, part of the warm up with ensuring that the boxers are doing the right thing before at least they go to the coach and have to do the, let's say, the more advanced part of their warm up and preparation. And then even in the cool down, being part in the cool down, ensuring that they have no injuries, making sure that they're doing the right things and the right strategies. This is a crucial role in competition and that pre and post bout particularly, but also in the days in between and in the preparation towards the competition and the days after a competition. So if you're full-time embedded in sport, particularly if you're full-time in boxing, a bit like, you know, full-time in football, your role almost never ends. You know, what you do in competition and training might be different, but it's a continuum really, because there are certain things you're just continuing. And then in competition, when you come back, you're going to continue those things. So, you know, sometimes when people talk about just being at competition, just thinking about the limelight and all the things that it brings with it, I say being at competition isn't sometimes as hard as when you are in the training environment, because that's where the hardest bits are. In competition, hopefully, the athlete is in a good state, because otherwise they wouldn't go to competition. It's getting them there, which is the hardest part. That's where the nitty gritty of things come. But we all know if you're working in elite sports and competition, you need to have that experience of, you know, not to panic under pressure, have to remain blue calm, not to be emotional. And obviously thinking about both performance and athlete welfare and putting them together.
Yeah, definitely. And you obviously mentioned some of the injuries that can happen, obviously acute injuries during the competition. But in general, in boxes, what are the most frequent injuries?
Yeah, so boxing is actually one of those sports where you can pick up any injury in the body. I think I've seen every joint and then every muscle group in boxing for different reasons. So if you had to be boxing specific, okay, I'd say the upper limb is probably your predominance of injuries. Hands and the wrist are your number one by far, hence why it's an area which I tend to educate about, and it's an area which I have self-educated and still do. You know, it's a never-ending thing where you keep on learning. But the upper limb is definitely big, so your hands, wrist, elbows and shoulders are big areas. You're obviously going to have some form of facial traumas, some head injuries, some neck, not as much as people would think. You know, people getting whacked in the face, trust me, you're going to have more injuries in the upper limb than you're going to have in this area. And most of the times is because, you know, you don't just stand still and get hit in the face. Boxers know how to move away. And when they get hit, they're conditioned for it also. So that's one of the things you have to remember. Then you will get the rest of the body. But for example, you can get overuse injuries in the lower limb. This is a weight managed sport. People are trying to make the weight. They're trying to lose weight at the period where maybe they're even increasing the training so that there's stress. So you can get overuse injuries in the lower limb. And that's, although it's not exactly happening in the sport and in the ring, it's happening as part of the overall preparation. But definitely, I'd say from a combat point of view, that upper limb is one of the areas which you definitely would want to focus the most, without forgetting the rest of the body. So it's not like football, where you do the lower limbs and you forget the rest. Maybe you do the back and then everything else, it's fine. In boxing, you look at the upper limb, but the rest of the body, you keep getting everything. So, you know, I don't think in over a decade, I think we've seen everything, as I said, you know, hips, knees, elbow, shoulders, but like any sport, we look at our incidence of injuries, but more importantly, we look at severity. So, because ultimately for me, I don't really care what is our number one injury by incidence. It's only good to know, you know, if they are the ones we tend to see the most because of potential time implication from a physio point of view. But severity is what keeps them away from training. So if the total accumulation is higher with something which provides lower numbers, I think that's going to be our priority. If something gives you lots, but then you don't lose lots of training, then it's probably not as important. And I think I like to mention that because you look at papers, you look at incidence and epidemiology, and I think actually hours lost tends to be probably more important.
Yeah, definitely agree, because sometimes it's more about the number of injuries rather than the time loss due to that injury. And so based on the on the upper limb, just for today, just discuss a little bit more about the shoulder. So for example, for your shoulder injuries, if you have to create a plan to prevent shoulder injuries, how would you then plan it within the training schedule that the boxers have?
Yeah, I mean, use a keyword prevention. I know, you know, if you looked even in social media, people will either be pro or against that word, because people will say you can never prevent. But then for me, it's a bit like talking about, you know, dental problems. You know, you brush your teeth to try and prevent things, but you'll have gum problems or you won't have gum problems. So you do the best. I think with the shoulders and other places, but we're talking about shoulders today, the best thing you can do is try and think about what are the commonalities you tend to see in those areas which tend to be of a certain deficiency. And I think as almost like a widespread, the best thing to do is work with your strength and conditioning coach particularly, and with the coaches, and to try and obviously from an S&C is provide the right level of conditioning in those areas. And then with the coaches is trying to monitor the volume and try and see how it reacts. But you have to imagine if you have a squad of 40 people and you want to be individualistic, then what you want to look at is how do certain people respond. And like in any sport, certain athletes will never get a shoulder problem. Certain athletes will be the ones that get your shoulder problems. Now, sometimes you can get your overuse, and those people that sometimes get overuse, they get better with certain approaches. And then you have like recurrences. And I think the best thing to do to cut those recurrences is see what works for them. And then how can you integrate that? Again, I use strength and conditioning and the coaches. How can you use that to try and create a better approach? With certain cases, you might want to look at their performance analysis to see if there's a particular thing within their technique, which together with the coaches, you can identify whether that can make a difference. Again, sometimes you don't know, but if you work with the coaches, they may say, yeah, that's not the right way of throwing the shot. Let's try that differently. And then we have seen a few cases which have really worked well by looking at that approach. And the other thing about, you have to think, it's beyond that, you know, hat of physiotherapy. I go back to certain things, you know, lifestyle, behavior. What do they do? Do they overtrain on the weekend? Do they not eat well? Do they not rest and recover well? So what you have to look at with those people that tend to be at risk, which is usually the ones you want to focus the most, because if no, somebody is new to the program and you do a screening of them, even if you find things, it's not necessarily mean they're going to get an injury. We know it from research, you know, otherwise people will have, you know, exact science on what to do in screening, which isn't the case. What you try and do is you try and screen a population, you try and get a best idea. But if people have been repetitively through your screening processes, you know what probably is more important for that particular person. And that's what we try and do. We try and understand, is somebody starting already with a deficit who we know is at risk? And then the other thing is, you know, that's your overuse. Those are your chronic type repetitive. You know, your acute traumas, sometimes it's very hard, is it? In any acute injury, how can you prevent somebody from getting an acute sudden trauma? You know, it's so much multifactorial. You know, you've got your fatigue, you've got the type of training that they sleep well and everything. So the best thing we can try and do, and we try and do that, is we collect wellness on a daily basis. And, you know, we look at the mood, the motivation, the sleep, have they recovered well? Are they carrying any injuries? and that gets flagged. And then we try and speak with the athletes to see what's happening. We speak with the coach and we see if there's anything there that, you know, might need a tweak so that, I don't know, you know, potentially, let's put it this way. If somebody didn't sleep really well, they feel really tired, the mood and motivation is really low, you just see the buildup of potential danger leading towards an injury. And, you know, it could be shoulder, it could be anything else, but definitely we're trying to look at that. So I think it's coming from having maybe that, okay, a bit more local approach, then the local approach about working with other disciplines, and then probably a wider context of the sport with other people, from your coaches to a multidisciplinary team, and thinking not just shoulder, I think then in that case, you're almost thinking more holistically the whole person.
So your athletes complete daily well-being survey, I guess, and then do they also do some objective measures in the morning when they come to the ground to train?
So objective measures for us, we don't do it for everybody, because otherwise, you know, I think, you know, is this something we have discussed and something we might consider in the future? Is there something simple that might give us a lot of information? I think you have to be careful, because you could overload with a lot of data and then, you know, it gives you nothing. And I think the danger of data, that's why we looked even last year, even because of COVID, it probably gave us a better opportunity. We spent the whole year working on a data management project to try and improve our working of data, so we're not collecting too much information and then not using a lot of it to try and reverse it. So collect less and use more probably was the way we looked forward. But with objective measures, we tend to use it for the right people. So, you know, if certain people need certain objective measures for the shoulder, whether it is strength, range, or some performance criteria, then we will incorporate them. And a lot of times what we tend to do is most likely will be in the beginning of a camp and the end of a camp. What do I mean by that? Every week, you know, our athletes, they train in a full-time environment, we class them as camps. So every week is a camp. And so we look in the beginning and the end. So you look for your trends of fatigue. You look at how somebody's improving week to week. And you use that as an objective measure of either, you know, progression or they're in a good place. It all depends on the timing of the year also. Some people may require more monitoring than others, but rather than have a blanket for everybody, because it's hard, isn't it? Not everybody gets the same injuries. Some get more shoulders, some get more elbows, some get more hands and wrists. You have to be careful, because otherwise you'd be collecting 10 sets of data for every athlete and, you know, your spreadsheets will never end. But for the people that we feel is needed, yes, we do create a strategy and then we agree we are going to be collecting this during these days, during this period.
Yeah, definitely a good approach. And then just we go to the last question. Obviously, as you mentioned in your introduction, you will be one of our guests for webinar on the 22nd of March. The title of the event will be Objective Measures for Sporting Shoulder. Are they of any use? So could you introduce the topic to our colleagues?
Yeah, so something I like to talk about, mainly because I've used all sorts of varieties over the years in different parts of the anatomy. But with shoulders, you know, we talk about objective measures. It is important to think about, you know, are there good objective measures to consider? Are they of any use? You know, are certain things just not worth looking at, or other things are worth really good? And actually, you can hang your hat if you have something like this, really helps. And I think if you're looking at the shoulder, I think one thing to consider also is there other things also linked to the shoulder that might be of use? So for example, is the thoracic spine something to consider when you're looking at the shoulder? And I think what I will probably want to present in that period of time, you know, on the 22nd of March, is what are the things I would consider for the sporting shoulder? How would you do it? So I think I usually tend to use three words, is the how, is the when, and also the why. You know, so the why is very important. I think why would you use it? What does it give you? The when is looking also as a bit like we're talking now, is how do you pick those different things? And then the how, you know, if you're looking at a particular test, how would you do it? You know, what is the sort of methodology that you would employ? What is, you know, out there maybe in the literature, or what have we sort of seen from using it, you know, realistics? Because again, sometimes what you see in the clinical literature doesn't mean that it is as easy to do and actually is going to give you the information you want. And I think most importantly is talking about what are easy tools and then what are more complex. You know, what is cheap equipment or what is more expensive equipment? You know, what's something that could be in your pocket versus something which you have to pay 40,000-50,000 pounds to use, like an isokinetic as an example. So it's trying to provide the people who want to join in a bit of an idea of, you know, are they of any use? Have a little debate. And obviously, I hope people will attend, so that, you know, more than happy then to answer any questions that they will have around that, what they see in their own practice, and even, you know, critique what I'll be saying. Because for me, what I say, it's not like, you know, I'm preaching and that is the golden rule. I can only come from my experience, from the experience of other colleagues that I bring along. So I'm always open to hear what other people have to say.
Yeah, definitely. And we want to remember like the format of the evening. So there will be a presentation from Ian first, but that will be a long time for you to ask all the questions that you want to Ian. And again, it will be on the 22nd of March, and the link to subscribe to the event is already out, so please go and have a look. And then Ian, thanks again for spending a bit of time with us and having a chat and talk about a lot of interesting things. But then we look forward to seeing you on the 22nd again.
Definitely tune in, guys, and you know, more than happy to answer your questions at the end.
Perfect. Thanks again, Ian, and thanks everybody for watching the episode, and we'll see you soon.